we're starting with Abraham and Sarah. We're about on the other side of Jesus is where we are today, which I think is an interesting way to think of it. We're that far on the other side of Jesus as we are today in the 20th century. And the first period that we began, we're beginning here in our study, and then all of this behind is a memory that these slave people have in Egypt. They have the memory of a parental couple, a founding couple, and that's Abraham and Sarah. And they have a memory of what were called the patriarchal families, Isaac and Rebecca, Jacob and Rachel, and then Jacob and Rachel, and then also Leah and 12 sons, one of them being Joseph, who went down to Egypt. And this was a story the slaves told about, how did we get down to this place? And, you know, how did we get here in the first place? There was a famine in the land, and Joseph was sold into slavery and rose up the pyramid. Remember, where's the Mad? Do you have the Mad magazine?
It's behind Carol.
Oh. The back cover of the new Mad magazine has exactly what God is about the world doing. Turning the pyramid upside down. Should I put that right here?
Yeah.
Okay. There. Now, the way I'm looking at it is when the people now, after the Exodus, after the saving event, whereby God really births them and brings forth a people to make this motley group of both Hebrew slaves and other slaves, to mold them together in one family. And this family will be God's very special family. And that's what we looked at, the Exodus, and then moves them out to the wilderness, the place of risk, the precarious place, the place of quietness, the place of solitude, there to teach them. Now here's the, if you want to say, thesis that we'll be going through these sessions with, is that in the wilderness, God seeks to teach these people a way to organize themselves and be as a society that is different than the model of the rest of the world, or the world around them at least, and that is the Egypt way. And that was the way of the pyramid and the hierarchies and the richer people exploiting the poorer people and the powerful people taking advantage of the weaker people. That now in the wilderness there's a whole new way of society and life that is to be taught. And that the first teaching now comes in the way that food is given. And I just listed again the story. The people cry for food. God gives manna. Manna is God's. And it's the first principle here that they own nothing. In the wilderness, God gives them their daily bread. Or they own no food, I should say. And there's enough manna for everyone, and it's shared with everyone. The gift is for all, and it's shared among all. It's a daily gift, except the seventh day. Immediately in the wilderness, God starts countering workaholism. You see? Except the seventh day, that's the day when you rest. And it's gathered, it's not dumped in your tent, so you're just lying on your pillow receiving it. It's gathered, there's dignity in work. And then the larger clans receive more, the smaller clans receive less, simply because how much does each person get each day?
Two quarts,
one omer. And then those who hoard, it rots, and Moses' emotional reaction with them is anger, because they would be starting to go back to the Egypt way of building a pyramid. And by this I mean a social pyramid, not the Egyptian pyramid. You know that. Then again, the seventh day of rest, there's no manna, but God provides enough on the sixth day. For the seventh day. Now, let's do what I suggested at the end last time, is just break again into groups of three, and just, if this, if you were going to form a society in a remote place on this earth, and it was a place on this earth where there's enough food there for everyone, think of it as a place where there's enough food provided. How would you, what are some ideas for a constitution for that society if this is the only basis you have for that society? You get it? And instead of writing out the whole thing, just get together for a few minutes in your buzz groups and talk about, and maybe jot down a few ways that society would be organized this way. So can you do that for 7 minutes? Let me. Would be okay. Question we're asking: what would a group of people living together, what would their life be like? So we maybe won't get a comprehensive, and we might decide it's impossible. But just share some of the things you came up with. What would this society be like? Wants to start.
Well, I guess we didn't talk about it, but I would. It's an idea that just crossed my mind in terms of what we have to work with. Our constitution here is rather small and limited, so there is a simplicity in the constitution, and that sort of pervades in terms of the way you think. There's seemingly not a lot of things to make life complicated, so our life is simple. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So should we start with that? It's simple.
We did talk about that. One of the things is gathering the food as an activity. So we talked about how we organize that in our society for the gathering of the food. And one idea of the food is that it's to be shared. Mm-hmm. So that concept of sharing then comes into our idea of gathering. That the work of gathering is to be shared also. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't become an activity of one particular person or group, but rather it is a function that should be done by everyone at some point in time. Mm-hmm. So you don't steer a person as a gatherer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's shared by everyone, the gathering and the sharing.
Yeah. We wonder who decided all these things.
Okay, where is the authority? Did all of you come up with that question? Mm-hmm. Who runs this show?
No.
I know you, man.
Where is the authority? Who's the boss?
Well, I don't know if June and Sandy agree to this, but things that immediately came to my mind were guaranteed employment, limited work week, you get the day off, a very progressive income tax. So, like, say if you decide you need $15,000 to live, anything more than that is taxed at like a 95% rate to pay for the needed Social Security for those who are unable to work.
Okay. You live you live on enough. If you have more, that goes to someone else.
Right, who doesn't have enough. The questions that we raised immediately were problems of human, greed and laziness. Because all those things I talked about remind me of the Soviet Union, where they have guaranteed employment, but people don't work hard because there's no incentive. Which is different from, I think, some small tribal societies where people do indeed work hard enough for the community. So it's the difference between a sense of community with 200 people or 275,000. So, I mean, none.
When I read about the early Pueblo towns in New Mexico, they were very, in the economic organization was very similar to this.
When he just was talking about the incentives, I thought that the society would need kind of an attitude of shared ownership in the society in order to have the dignity to work and to want to work.
Shared ownership. In other words, that brings the dignity to the work.
Shared ownership of what? The land?
Or
the society.
The whole society, is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Shared ownership of society. Well, I think it's a sense of family, where you have a sense of the whole society as a family. Which was an amazing thing in the desert. It was Hebrews and other people that became a family.
We didn't talk about it, but I suppose the only thing that would hold that together would be the ongoing consciousness that it was God's gift, and spending that seventh day in thanksgiving and in worship, praise, acknowledging.
I think this is almost what you might call an absolute. That there has to be a mindset of all is God's gift, therefore a mindset of thanksgiving. What else did you?
Worshiping.
Yeah.
Giving something.
A mindset of worship and thanksgiving, for the gift. And then equal to this, the opposite of this mindset is also the mindset is, now this is a hard one, I think, and this is this mindset, I own nothing. Wow. Yeah, I own nothing. It all comes from God. God gives the manna. A further thing that I... Oh, let me get some more of your ideas.
There has to be ritual developed there to keep this attitude and mindset, to keep it before the people. Mm-hmm. The purpose of all this is.
There's definitely a way of ritual. And there's a ritual hinted at here is the holy jar. That somehow you must do some type of ritual around the holy jar to constantly remind you of this is our way of life. And we won't take the time to study the whole sacrificial system of animals, but it is also a ritual to constantly remind you that you own nothing. The sacrificial system that develops now is you give the first and you give the best to God as a constant recognition that you own nothing, that it all belongs to God.
What would happen to the rebel, the one who rebelled against it?
When you read into the laws, like in Leviticus, what happens to the rebel?
Stoned.
Just goodbye.
When are we going to have that in this community?
I don't know. Mm-hmm.
That seventh day has to be part of the ritual, too, consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the power of the seventh day ritual, and I think the gift of the seventh day, and it's so important. I think I like to put it in kind of a chart form or something, or because I think it relates so much to the way life isn't today. Is that one way to put it? The seventh day is a reminder that and I think here's the deepest question. What is the very purpose of life? What is the very purpose of life? And now I, When you look at all of Scripture, these things seem to emerge, and I think you can read them now back into the story. That's what I'm doing, and I can be argued with, I'm sure. But the purpose of life in the Bible is to live in harmony with God, with others, and with nature. In our first semester, Elmer added anything else that exists that we don't have categorized under God, humans, and nature. Whatever that might be. But the very purpose of life is to live in unity, live in harmony, or another word is to live in fellowship. And now the Sabbath is a reminder that the purpose of life is not work. Because work becoming the purpose of life then leads to accumulation, and then accumulation becomes the purpose of life, and then having stuff becomes the purpose of life. And then you're on your way again to an Egypt system where the rich have the most purpose in life and the poor down there don't. Or another way to put it is that manna now is God's gift to sustain people to live out this purpose in life. And the problem that the human being is always trying to do is to go to the manna to say, give me the purpose in life, by accumulating more and more and more of the stuff. And that's why, obviously, Moses is so angry when some people start hoarding it. Because it's not just that they're being selfish. I mean, it's much deeper. They are starting to have a vision of another way to organize a society. That is according to the purpose of the life being climbing your way up to wealth and to accumulation instead of this being... And Sabbath fits this in with this so perfectly, because now we're going to look in that covenant community. The time that is glorified is the time of rest. Work you do to sustain yourself for the Sabbath. Because at the time of rest, you can most intently do what life is all about, and that is live in a deep sense of harmony. And have parties and have fun with other human beings and enjoy God and enjoy nature. Rest. I'm moving on from this, but the reason I wanted us to struggle with this question a little is to see that the Bible here, especially now in the Hebrew Bible, is talking about a way of human organization, according to a specific sense of what life is, over against another answer of what then it would say life is not. Well, should we move on? Is that, how do I say this? You got it so far? I don't know what else. Well, the important thing now for us is to move on and see how in the covenant law, how this kind of life now is set up. Now, one thing I could begin to answer now is the question of authority, or a question of leadership, which we have to begin to struggle with the biblical concept of authority that is so different than our normal human concept of what I would call bossism. And bossism is that the human being climbs up to a certain position where that human being then can set the rules for the people below him or her. That's bossism. And that's one answer to what authority is. And I'm going to erase this whole thing. And we're going to see that the type of society they organized is really a theocracy. Meaning God is here and God has shown a way of life, and that way of life is the boss. And then now you have all of these people down here that have a society of equality. But then out in the desert, now the next thing after the manna, and this is now in chapter Exodus chapter 18, Moses picks leaders. Moses picks leaders. And he gives them two responsibilities. Moses gives them, first is to serve the people. And then this is chapter 18, verse 26. And then to administer justice. And basically then what the leader is to do by this word administer justice is, if this person here starts getting to be a big deal and becoming a boss by accumulating and becoming wealthy and then taking advantage of others and taking their manna away, then the purpose of the leader is to administer the kind of justice where this won't happen. Well, it's beginning to, because they look to leadership always to the way of life rather than to a person. It's a hard question of what leadership is, and it's going to be hard too when we get to Jesus. But this is the background of Jesus. Remember at the Last Supper, it says, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And then he gave the towel and basin and showed this is the type of leadership that will be in the new community. And so that's a continual struggle. What does it mean to be a leader? And I don't quite have it down yet. Can you tell? Okay, but if we could maybe look through the scriptures now, the type of leadership the Bible opposes and the type of leadership that it exalts. And now I want to move from there now to this great event now that happens in the wilderness. And if I call the Exodus the birth, now I would call in the wilderness, it's called the Mount Sinai, and I call it the wedding. It's like a wedding. And we're going to read just part of the wedding. In chapter 19, now God says to Moses, verse 4, "You yourselves have seen what I did with the Egyptians and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. From this you know that now if you obey my voice and hold fast to my covenant, you of all the nations shall be my very own, for all the earth is mine, and I will count you a kingdom of priests, a consecrated nation. And these are the words you are to speak to the children of Israel." So now Moses summons all the people together and he says, get ready for a wedding. And it's wedding language. Just listen to this. "Go to the people and tell themselves to prepare themselves today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothing and hold themselves in readiness for the third day. You know, get all your nice clothes together, wash them, get ready for this big event." And then it's called the Theophany on Sinai. And you remember the story how Moses goes up into the cloud of Sinai and the people are gathered around and it says, don't touch the mountain, you'll die. Now this is serious stuff going on here. And then Moses comes out of the mountain and then has these words for the people in chapter 20. And this is covenant making. God spoke all these words, "I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." It starts with God's grace. "And therefore, because I will do this, now begins the way of life that the people will live." And then promises are made. God makes a promise, and here's God's promise. will be your God, and then I will bring you to land. And then the people make the promise, we will follow, or we will obey your way. And with these promises, we have really a marriage of the people and God. So I call it the wedding. God and the people now are together forever. And now the next metaphor I like to use after wedding is now what I call the wedding gift. And the wedding gift is a beautiful and wonderful way of life that God gives them to live. And here we have to divorce ourselves from the typical, I'm assuming, except for Renee, most of you were raised Lutheran. Am I right? Well, I know. We know you. And as Lutherans, we have had a very negative understanding of the word law. The law we have been taught, the law is this hard, heavy thing that drives you to despair. And you get crushed by it, and you say, oh, what an awful person I am. And then after you have been crushed by the law, then you are open to receive God's grace. Do you know what does this ring a bell with you? It was how we were taught to preach. You know, a 15-minute sermon, a 20-minute sermon, first 10 minutes law, you crush them. You know, until they're all flattened out. And then the last 10 minutes of the sermon, then grace. You know, then you give them the comfort of even if you can't do all of this stuff, you're still okay. Does this ring a bell of any type of... And because of this, you know, and there's truth in this. We have to say this. I mean, there actually is truth in Lutheranism. I say that. Obviously, I'm a Lutheran pastor. I mean, there is that sense where there are those events in life when we are literally kind of nailed to the wall and just cry out for God's mercy and help. But we have tended to make the law only that, you know, which nails us to the wall, and forget that to the Hebrew people and the Jewish people, the law was a wonderful, wonderful gift of a beautiful way of life to live that was a way of happiness and the way of peace and the way of shalom. And it's hard for us to visualize how the psalmist could say, oh, how I love your law. Day and day I meditate on your law. And Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, remember when he wished he were a rich man? Wish I were a rich man. Then what did he say if he were a rich? Why did he want to be a rich man?
So he wouldn't have to work hard.
Yeah, so every day would be Sabbath, so he could do what? Study the law. Just sit in the holy books. All day, every day, just sit with the holy books and read the holy books. Because this is happiness. This is joy. This is a shalom way of life. It's a wonderful gift of God that God has given to people to live in harmony with God and in harmony with each other. Now, I needed to say that at the beginning, so it's sometimes better for us to use the word instead of law. That God gives these people a wonderful word as a wedding gift of a way to live their life together. Now, the rest of our session today, I want to just look at some of the wonderful ways that God gives these people to live together. And there were also some real problems in the way that these laws are that I don't even know how to state that. Like any, all kinds of little things you did wrong, you got killed for them. And it's where I think Jesus finally goes to the deepest joy of the law and digs out its very depths and seemingly rejects part of the law in digging to its deepest depths. And it's important for us that Jesus never negated the Jewish law. He only dug deeper into it. Now, this on the little pamphlet, now this is on page 3, and I'm not going to look at the passages. They would be under page 3 on your sheet, and that's what, if you would look those up, it's just interesting to read some of these old ways of society being set up. And there's many types of law in this way, and I'm just picking out the one that have more to do with food, because that's our kind of the way we're going, or what we're focusing on in these sessions is food and eating and manna. But, I'll just read these on page 3 and then make some comments on them. Okay, the first one is the tithe. You will give 1/10 of everything to God, the first and the best. And the part of this is my interpretation of it. Thus you will remember that everything belongs to God. Now this was a wonderful way that people had to remember that. The word here now is when you go into the land I will give you and you get a good crop, you're going to be tempted to think, wow, look at this massive crop I got. I think I'll keep it. And it says, no, the best and the first tenth goes to God. And you have this wonderful way to always remind yourself that everything comes from God and you don't own anything. So that's the tenth. Now, this is the way that is organized then, the tenth that you give. You are on a 3-year cycle with your tithe. A 3-year cycle, and one of the 3 years your tithe goes to the poor, the wanderer, meaning the foreign stranger that's wandering through the land, and also to the priests. One out of every 3 years it goes to them. Now the concept of this is that God gives manna to everybody. A stranger walking through the land doesn't have a field, but God gives that person manna. So your tithe then becomes the way God filters the manna through you to that person. Now you already notice that in the Old Testament society there is no sense of charity. By charity meaning I have something I own that I give to a poor person. You have only the concept of manna that is filtered through me to the poor person. Do you already see the difference between that and saying, I own something that I'm going to give to this person? God gives equally to everyone. If I have excess, and the tenth is always a reminder that I have excess. And that goes. Now that's one year out of 3. What do you do the other 2 years? This is marvelous. Every 2 years you take your tithe to the temple area, bring your whole clan there and eat it. Have a marvelous feast on your best crops at the temple. Now, why would they organize themselves to do this? It's by eating it together. First of all, it's a way of telling themselves that God wants us to have marvelous feasts and to enjoy God's blessings. But by taking it and doing it at the temple area, you remind yourselves that it is God's gift. So that was 2 out of every 3 years. Do you like this society so far? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, then I make the sentence here. The tithe frees you, or think of the word liberation. The tithe liberates you from keeping for yourself and your family what God intends for others. And it also liberates you from starting to think that you own it. That's what the tithe does. It liberates you from that captive or imprisonment or slave idea that you own it. Okay, now the second. This is how you harvest your crops. God says, I want you to be very, very careless in your harvest. Don't mow up to the wall. But here you have a wall around your field. Here's the grain. Slash, slash, slash. You leave a foot or so strip. Never go up to the wall. And also, you can only slash once. You don't slash into it the second time. Because then when you're all through harvesting, you walk away with the manna for your family from your land. And then the sojourners, the wanderers through the land, and those for whom misfortune has fallen and they have lost their land, then they move in and there's God's manna for them. And again, it's no sense at all that you're giving that to them. You're leaving it as you take what belongs to you to sustain your family. And what's the wonderful and beautiful story in the Old Testament about the gleaner?
Ruth.
Yeah, she was poor. And here she comes into the land of Boaz, is that his name? Trivia. Boaz, you know, and she does the gleaning. And in no way is there any sense that Boaz saying, oh, am I a wonderful rich person? I'm giving her charity. This is God's manna for her. And the society is set up so you leave. There's also rules about for a fruit tree, how many times you can shake it. And you only get what drops on the first shake. Because then the fruit that is left is again for the sojourner, for the poor, and also for the animals. Then I put this, Yahweh needs your excess to feed the poor and the foreigners. To keep everything for yourself would hinder God's manna giving. See, you never give charity, you only have the choice of hindering God from giving manna to some people. Now, third, never put a muzzle on the ox as it's treading on the threshing floor. Muzzle not the ox that treadeth on the grain. God's man is for the animals too. And if you put a muzzle on the mouth of your ox, then the ox can't eat. And you're denying God's manna for the ox. You get it? So this is God's gift. And so it's always the temptation is to stop God's manna flow to an animal, to a stranger, to a poor person. And now do you see how this leads to shalom? Is that as long as this is happening, there is not war. There isn't violence. But it's only when some people start hoarding and then they have to start protecting and then those without have to start attacking. See how simply this is called the way of shalom. Then again, the Sabbath. You will not work on the seventh day and the seventh year. And not only did you get one day off a week, you got one year off every 7 years. The law has every possible way of thinking to have you have time off from work. If you were married, you got a year off. So that year, you got 2 years off out of seven, unless you got married on the Sabbath year. All kinds of way to try to think of ways you wouldn't have to work. Because work is only for sustaining life. And if you work all the time, that is like mowing up to the stone wall. You get that? Do you see? You can have enough to feed yourself and your family by working 6 out of 7 years. Or if you take a year off when you're married, there's still enough for you. If you take 1 year out of 7, there's still enough. To work beyond that is to go up to the wall. Thus, you will remind yourselves that life is not work and accumulation, but friendship with God, others, and nature. So this is the way it worked on the seventh year. You didn't do any planting, you didn't do any harvesting, and you had enough from the sixth year to sustain your family for the seventh. And then kind of natural things would grow up in your field on the Sabbath year when you're not working. Again, that's for the poor and for the strangers and for the animals. Notice how there's a sense of fitting in with nature, both giving nature a rest, being sensitive to nature, and also providing for animals. The more you read into this covenant, you can sense the interweaving of all the forms of life in their mutual receiving of God's blessings.
But that would be storing up then, or was this that not everyone took this seventh year at the same time, and so those who were working and supplying shared with others?
I think it was the same year.
Then you would have to store up,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, accumulating, accumulating is fine for the sake of the Sabbath. That is the only, this is the fun exception. You get to accumulate, to store up, to sustain you over the seventh day and over the seventh year.
The second question, was this ever truly in effect in Israel?
That's a question we're going to ask. You know, is this dream world? Is this a dream world, or did it ever happen? And so can you hold that just until we get... I could just give you a preview. I think it was honestly tried and quickly fell apart. Then I think the most marvelous thing, and read the whole, if you would just read the whole chapter of Leviticus 25, this is the chapter of Jubilee year. So not only did something wonderful happen every seventh day and every seventh year, but then during a period of time, society, the law here, or the word new, that society would begin to move to the Egyptian model, meaning that some people would lose their land, misfortune would fall, they'd go into debt, somebody might not be a good manager or something, and they would fall into debt, and therefore they would have to sell their land, and a neighbor would buy up their land. And then that person might work for the neighbor, or even if misfortune really fell you, you had to sell yourself into slavery to a neighbor. And the danger is now that society would gradually go to the Egyptian pyramid model of the richer up here and the poorer, the landowners and the landless. And then God in his wisdom, if you have this as a statement of faith, God in God's wisdom, says, among my chosen people, this must never happen. So gives this wonderful word that on the 50th year, you'll blow the Jubilee horn. And then everything goes back to gold. Everybody that's lost their land gets their land back. Everybody that sold themselves into slavery is freed. You get your land back, everything is back to the way it started, and we're all equal again. And then a 49-year period goes, and it starts getting a little out of whack, and then blow the horn, 50 years, everybody back. And there's a sense that runs through the whole Hebrew Bible that your land is a precious loan to you from God. And nobody else but your family can have that land because it's God's manna gift to you and your family. And that's why at the end of 50 years, it is equalized again. What it's called is it's built-in nonviolent revolution. It's a society that decides to have a nonviolent revolution and land reform program every 50 years. Another part of this I don't mention here is debt. If somebody runs into hard times and needs to borrow some money, you can loan them money, but there's no thought that you would ever charge interest for that money. Because if you have money to loan, that's excess. And you would never make money off of excess money. That would be incredible. So you loan that money, and then on the Sabbath year, it is simply said, if you had extra manna and you loaned it, well, you really didn't need it anyway. So at the, every Sabbath year, all debts are canceled. You've borrowed money, it's all forgiven. At the end, are you beginning here to see the seeds of the Lord's Prayer?
You know, what boggles my mind is how come the primitive people do that and we well have the Bible don't?
We who?
I said, we have the Bible and we don't do that, and you go straight to primitive culture. I was in New Zealand and the Maori. When they come into the cities, they cannot understand. Somebody, they all of a sudden, they've got a job and people are telling them to buy things, and then somebody comes and wants to collect. Do you need it? No. Well, how come you're asking me? They don't understand the concept. But, you know, in any primitive people, they live more by this than we do.
There, you read that among what we sometimes call more primitive people, that I've read this about Africa and societies in Africa. If you ever have anything excess and you see somebody else with not enough, you just simply, you know, there's a deep sense within you that it's not yours, but it's theirs. Oh. Maybe.
But many times only if it's your one talk, a member of your clan or your tribe.
Okay, and that's also true here now in the Hebrew covenant law. This is very, very ethnic. If you have a slave who is a non-Hebrew, that person is not freed. You can charge interest to a person who is a non-Hebrew. And when we, I keep wanting to jump ahead because it's so much fun. This was probably one of the major reasons Jesus was finally crucified. Because he dared to say this was for all. That, We'll see that when we get to Jesus' economics.
Dan, I want to jump ahead a little as long as you said jump ahead. You introduced Ruth, and then you didn't say what happened to her. Boaz was, because he was the big guy, he was so good to her and let her glean, and finally he made her his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a son who became the father of Jesse.
Who was the father of?
Who was the father of David.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And the story probably came out at the same time as the Jonah story, when Ezra was telling everybody to get rid of their foreign wives. So you had this protest story coming right in the midst of that social situation, saying, look, the grandmother of your great King David was a Gentile. That must have blown them.
And when Jesus says the only sign I'll give you is the sign of Jonah, usually we interpret that to mean 3 days in the belly of the fish, the equivalent of 3 days in the tomb and then resurrection. And another sign of Jonah would be that the gift is for all.
Yeah. We forget that, don't we? The sign of... And we'll see, too, when Jesus gives his inaugural sermon in Nazareth, he says all this kind of manna kind of stuff, and they all think it's wonderful. Of course they do, they're the poor people of the land. And then at the end of his sermon, he closes the book and says it's for everybody, and then they lead him to throw him off a cliff. And that's, and what you say, Carolyn, probably is true of where this does operate in the world today. It's very narrow to your own clan. Well, that's just some of the ways this society now. And there's the deepest sense that you have to catch is the spirituality of of stuff, of God's blessings. And that is this spirituality that I don't own anything. What comes is a blessing and a gift of God. I don't own anything. And my life's purpose is not that stuff, but that stuff is to sustain me for the beautiful life of harmony and shalom in relationship to God, others, and creation that God wants me to live. That's the spirituality. And without this spirituality, this cannot work. And that might be getting to answer. Say, why isn't it working in the Soviet Union? That might.
What led to the need for this Jubilee year in the first place? I mean, why were people buying and purchasing land from others? Why did some people have to sell themselves into slavery if there was all this sharing and tagging and so on going on?
You know, it must have been written in because of just the realism of this happening. And it was an attempt in the law to constantly remind the society that we go back to God's intention as we begin to slip. Does that make sense? Now, I want to lead you to the whole book of Deuteronomy, and we're not going to read it, I'm just going to tell you about it. That's, again, on page 3. When the people whom God had birthed and married and instructed reached the boundary of the promised land, and this is the book of Deuteronomy, or most of it, that Moses preaches a series of stirring sermons, and in these sermons, and at the point now, where you have to look is that we're right at the period here when the people are going to move from this boundary. Think of this as a boundary, and they come from the east, so I'll come from this way. And on this side is the wilderness, and on this side is the land. And now they're all here right at the borderline. And think of them, whatever, how many ever there were. Moses up on a rock, and he preaches a series of stirring sermons to these people at this place in the life where they are. And the sermons are this: when you go into the land, constantly return to the boundary and look into the wilderness, and then the word would be remember. That as landed people, you are to live the life you learned in the wilderness. Because your temptation and seduction when you are landed is going to be like the other landed people who are around you. And you want to become like them, and that would be returning to Egypt. So those are the sermons. And there's one, if you just want to get a touch of those sermons, read Deuteronomy 4:41 through 8:20 on your sheet. And you don't have to read the whole passage, just pick out some parts to see what Moses is saying to the people. And this is what the Brueggemann tapes are about. And how many of you had, most of you had a chance to listen to these parts, part of the Brueggemann tape? And you see where what I just said fits into his whole, I don't know how to start or ask a question. What do you think of his tapes? What did they say to you? Maybe that's not
a... I like this continual analogy of bringing that story always to the present.
Mm-hmm.
Go back in today.
Yeah.
Go back to what you made. In terms of what we're doing as individuals, community, as a nation, that leads us away from the wilderness. We need to go back to the boundary. and it's kind of
I appreciated so much how he wasn't just talking about the past, but he was constantly, and I haven't heard it yet, but I guess after his last session, the pastors or all the professional church met with him in here for a discussion of it, and I guess it was a wild discussion. Goodness, I mean, this is one thing to say, how do we live this? And I just discovered it's on tape, I want to listen to the. I want to listen to what the reaction was. What were other responses to that? What were images that captured you in it? Anybody take a note?
I used them right away, so you know, I didn't write anything down.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. One comment you made was that we are both children of land with its security and management, as well as being children of wilderness with its precariousness.
Did you ever sense, well, I'm sure, that's a dumb question maybe, but did you ever sense the tension between living in American society and being a follower of Jesus? Has anybody ever sensed there's a tension? And I'm wondering, does the Brueggemann tape, maybe it doesn't help us get out of it, but does it help us sense what the tension is? Is it, we are such landed people, and we operate in such management and ownership and on and on and on and on. And yet the biblical witness calls us in the midst of all of that back to the wilderness, to be wilderness people.
You referred through all the tapes time and time again about going back to the boundary and looking at it not through the Pharaoh's eyes, but through the wilderness of God.
Yeah, in the speeches, it's a constant call to go. Doesn't he often use the phrase "back to the boundary"?
Yes,
back to the boundary. And then he says that Moses actually was reminding the people to go back to the boundary all the time, back to the boundary. And I think it begins to tell us what our ritual should be. And it's something you could begin to think about. Is Holy Communion a time when we are called back to the boundary, back to the wilderness? There to see once again, and then with that vision to go again into the world, and then we start getting it messed up again. So we're called back to a ritual that leads us back to the boundary to see again the vision. Then we move for the week back into the city, back into the landedness, and then in the ritual we go back to the wilderness. Is it an easy life?
I think the book that David read on the story of the Baptist,
the fellowship is going to say the same thing in different words. Mm-hmm. How does it say it? Yeah.
That you come back to the Eucharist and you know that there is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you are intent on getting peace in the world, you
follow through to the cross. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Perhaps you need natural death. No. Some have called the cross the final wilderness, where Jesus was in total risk and total precarious, total trust. Because if there's one word that describes the life in the wilderness, it's one of trust. Totally trust in God and not yourself. Yeah. You had to go to bed at night trusting that God would have the manna there in the morning. It's out of your hands. You were a receiver. And if you go from this place or go from the Eucharist with this vision, in some ways your life is going to be miserable. In some ways it's going to be beautiful. Do you know what I mean?
That's the whole question. How do we take it from here?
Yeah. Because you'll never be able, you'll always be walking in our society with a different vision than that society holds. That's hard. And yet, when you start the path of the wilderness, there's a sense of the joy of it that you never want to go back.
I read some of last fall's notes, and I think once you said, because of living in community, either here or at home, it's easier because you have companions.
Mm-hmm.
Doing, trying to do the same thing. That's one of the hard things about it. You have to find a spot and get some friends or acquaintances who believe somewhat the way you do. Just need to have a little courage to go ahead. And
well, it's 12. Is it not? All of assignment. Read the time of the judges. The time, Carolyn, this is partly the time of the judges, I think, is when the people, and under the early King David, under David's kingship, the people really tried to live the covenant, and in some ways succeeded. But read the time of the judges, and then the kingdom of Saul. Saul was God's big blunder. God picked Saul to be the first king, and then said, "Why did I ever do that?" And the kingdom of David. And Solomon's. It isn't too much reading, is it?
What are the pages in there?
I'll be up through 43. Up through 43. And then in Bible reading, if you catch up on the page 3 readings in here, and then then we'll do page 4 next time too. So if you make a note of this, the first one, Joshua 13:8 through 21:45, just say don't read that. You might want to just pick out a few passages, but it's a long, long, boring description of how the land was divided.
Which is that?
It's dividing the land, Joshua 13:8 through 21:45. Then read the covenant at Shechem, and then the argument for a king and an argument against a king. And you might not understand why I had to read those, but it'll come together next time.